Hi, I'm going to be talking about embedded systems hacking. This is not going to be hacking into embedded systems. This is actually going to be how to build yourself a nice little black box to assist in either hacking or denial of service or anything you really bloody want. Actually, a good segue was what we just saw previously with the wearable computers. This is indeed a type of embedded system. So I'm not going to get into it because, to be honest, I know squat about video, and it's basically all about video. Everyone knows what an embedded systems is. I mean, if it wasn't for it, embedded systems, telecommunications as we know it wouldn't exist already. The modems, the telephone switches, the routers, everything that most people go through to get into the internet and get through the internet is an embedded systems. Basically, what this is a computer that's built into a box, usually no real accesses other than telnet, some sort of an Ethernet or T1 port. There's no keyboard, there's no monitor, and it does a very specialized purpose. So it doesn't do 3 trillion things just like your PC does, unfortunately. Though some people end up throwing in little fun hooks. If you know the right commands, you can suddenly play Space Invaders on your modem. But this is a little unusual. Most people don't bother to do embedded systems, even though these could be convenient in the hacking environment. Specifically, you can build a nice little small box that's easy to avoid in detection. You can throw something in a Kleenex box. No one knows what it is, and yet you can be sitting there sniffing for all you want. But no one seems to do it. Partially it's because no one seems to be truly aware that they can build a nice little box, or they don't think they have the skill set to do it. It's really pretty easy nowadays. There's actual, if you go into Embedded Systems Journal on the back, you've got demo boards. These demo boards will have everything you want on it. There's going to be a built-in processor. You'll probably have an Ethernet port, a T1 port. All you have to do is throw software on it. And most manufacturers even provide software for you. So it's not very difficult anymore. Another problem most people consider involved with embedded systems is price, because you're actually going to have to buy all your individual components. You're going to have to go out and get an i960. You're going to have to go out and get a T1 chip. Or you have to get the demo board. Now, one of the easiest ways to avoid the price thing is to salvage from old ports. You've got a 386 sitting around you've got no use for. Haul out your soldering iron and yank that chip. Find an old Ethernet card. Yank the chip there. Suddenly, you're not having to pay for components. You just have to slap them all together, which is not that difficult. In addition, a lot of manufacturers still offer their demo boards for free or for very little because they want you to use their product, and they think by offering this to you very conveniently that you are far more likely to go buy a lot of their product. Okay, so we're not going to, but they don't have to know that. Now, you do have to know where to be able to get these things. If you're not going to be yanking them from your boards, then you're going to have to find vendors and manufacturers. You can go directly to the person who makes the chip. You can go to Intel if you want an i960 or Motorola for a power PC. But the chances are they're not going to give you anything because they don't care about the individual person. You're going to have to find vendors. Now, the good news is if you go onto a company's website, they're going to list the vendors. You give one of them a call up, and most of them will end up sending you some sample chips. One or two of the cheap stuff, of the more expensive stuff, maybe 10, 12 of the cheaper stuff. I've sometimes gotten EEPROMs this way. Call up enough vendors, you can get a couple hundred if you need them. Now, there's plenty of uses for embedded systems. One is to just be a sniffer. You can monitor and record traffic, or only specific traffic if you want. The one problem with this, with an embedded systems over a standard computer on this, it would be storage, because you may not be able to come in and be able to yank your floppy or a flash card or whatever you're going to be using regularly, and you don't want to make this a huge box. Another use for embedded systems would be denial of service. You can actually build a box who will sit on the network for a day collecting MAC addresses and IP addresses and then suddenly start spitting out garbage packets, large packets, something else, with a completely spoofed IP and a spoofed MAC address so that nobody knows where it's coming from. And there's no real way to trace it back because ideally, with a little bit of social engineering, you've plugged it directly into somebody's network. You can use this also to filter or block certain messages. If you want to screw people up badly, you can block everything from www.microsoft or whatever you want. Just stick a little box in it and just have all these things go into a black hole. So there's plenty of uses for this. One guy I was talking to yesterday is actually building a little keystroke recorder that he wants to ideally fit into his into a keyboard. So it'll just sit there and record every keystroke typed on the keyboard. Once again, this is quick, convenient, and something that embedded systems is ideal for. Now there's going to be some fundamental skills if you're going to try and do embedded systems. You're going to need to be able to program. You need assembly. You also probably need C. Some people can do embedded systems completely in assembly, but this is fairly rare nowadays. Most everyone uses C once you get off the initial driver level. So if you want to try and do this, know some assembly, know some C. Those are the two main languages. If you know Java, wonderful, go away. You're also going to need some hardware knowledge. You need to know which end of the soldering iron is hot. Ideally, you need to know a little bit about how to wire a breadboard, what a breadboard is, how to actually solder on chips, what a capacitor is, some basic, simple parts about hardware. You're going to need to know how to get information on the chips you want and how to get samples. Again, most of the time, you can go straight to the manufacturer's website and get information. They'll have the entire specs there. I downloaded a bunch. They'll tell you how to get examples, sample code. They'll tell you distributors. You can find out how to get everything. Another good source is the Embedded Systems Journal. That thing, if you go back, the last 20 pages of it's basically all advertisements, how to get yourself chips, demo boards, anything you really want that makes it easy for embedded systems. Well, there we go. That's the basic overview of what the heck an embedded system is and why you would actually want to do anything with it. Let's get down to actually some details because we really want to know how to actually do this. So let's start off with some processors. You can start off with, I've got listed here first the main RISC processors. There's the Intel i960. Now, I personally don't like this. I'm actually programming on it currently, and I don't like the chip. Part of the problem is with all Intel chips, you have a big endian, little endian issue. Now, if you actually want your numbers to look like the numbers you intend them to be, this is not the chip for you. An addition problem with the i960 is it's expensive, and there's nothing built into it. It's just a microprocessor, which means if you want to have serial ports or anything else, nothing's built into it. You have to buy it all externally and hook it all in. I don't like the i960. However, everybody uses it. There's compilers for it everywhere. You can find a GNU C compiler that'll do i960. It's convenient. Everyone knows how to do something with it generally. There's a good knowledge base behind it. So there's one benefit with the i960. But then we can go down to the Motorola PowerPC, and this is actually better. There's almost as much of a common base for it. Almost as many people use the PowerPC as the i960. But unlike the i960, it actually does not have the big endian, little endian issue. Your numbers come out nice and normal. They have built-in SCCs, which are serial ports, so that you can actually hook up other pieces of equipment to this without having to do too much terrible engineering. It's got DRAM controllers built in. It's cheaper than the Intel. And again, you can usually find compilers everywhere. In fact, I use a GNU C compiler when I'm doing PowerPC compiles. So if you want to go with a RISC chip, my personal preference would be the Motorola PowerPC. Another common RISC chip is the MIPS, but not many people use the MIPS. It's got some built-ins to it. The big problem with it, it's not very common, it's not very sexy. Of course, because of that, you're actually going to be able to get lots of samples of them because the company is desperate to pawn them off on anybody. So this is the one benefit with the MIPS. The MIPS is similar in construction to the PowerPC. It's got built-in DRAM controllers. It's got built-in SCCs. It does not have the big endian, little endian issue. So if you're looking for just dirt cheap, a MIPS is probably where you want to go. You can also then bow down to some of the lower-level processors. There's the Intel 8051, which you can probably pick up for about, depending on the speed of the processor, from anywhere from $1 to $10 a processor. So it's very, very cheap, even if you're not getting samples. The one problem is it doesn't have an awful lot of horsepower. We're talking this is an 8-bit processor. You can do some incredible things with it, but you're probably going to have to write in assembly, and you're going to have to write some really clever and some really tight code. I've got friends that have implemented full 56K modems using it in 8051, and that took a year and a half of engineering to end. They were constantly having to tweak the code to keep it to keep the 8051 powerful enough to do this. I mentioned earlier 386. You can yank a 386 off of one of your motherboards and use that, and it'll probably have enough power for what you want. Some companies actually make what they call a PC on a chip, and it's basically a 386 or a 486 on a small board, usually with built-in serials and an Ethernet port. You can go ahead and do that, but let's admit it. I happen to think if you're going to use a PC chip, you're cheating. We're talking embedded systems. We're not trying to make this easy, okay? So this basically covers processors. Everyone's probably got a different processor they know of. They've got different flavors that everyone likes. Some people like the Pico. Once again, use what you like. There's plenty of them out there. I'm just covering some of the basics. When we come to I/O devices, then you've got your basic Ethernet. You've got a T1. You even have wireless or ADSL if you want to get really exotic. If you're going Ethernet, there's a lot of different Ethernet controllers out there. My first preference is probably the Davicom chip because it's cheap. Cheap is always a good thing. You could always just yank off of an old Ethernet card that you don't like anymore. No one's using your old 16-bit ISA, but that doesn't mean the chip is bad. Depending on how old the card is, though, the chip may no longer be made, in which case you're going to have some difficulties actually getting some specs on it. So that's the one thing to keep be aware of if you're actually going to recover from old hardware. Just about everybody makes an Ethernet controller. This makes it easy. I went on the web and did a basic search, and there's the Davicom. AMD makes one. Cirrus Logic, National Semiconductor. You name the manufacturer of ICs, and they're probably going to make an Ethernet controller. You can get 10 megabit controllers. You can get 100 megabit. You can get ones that'll switch from either way. Personally, you're probably going to stick with a 10 megabit, mostly because of price, mostly because you have no need to go to 100 megabit Ethernet for whatever situation you're going to be using for it. T1 controllers are a little bit more tricky because some T1 controllers you have to get two chips for, specifically a line interface chip, which is what actually connects up to the line and talks to it, and then you have a framing chip, which actually packetizes everything and sends it out. So if you're going to be looking into doing something with T1 or even E1 applications, you're going to want to check to see if you're going to be doing a single chip or a multiple chip solution. I'd recommend a single chip. They tend to be cheaper than buying two separate chips. Plus, let's admit it, it's easier if you've only got one chip to wire in than to do two chips. One of the more popular single chip solutions would be the Siemens. Well, it's now Infion because Siemens split off their embedded systems group. They make a very good T1 chip. Cirrus Logic, on the other hand, does a two-chip solution, which actually isn't bad if you want to go with a two-chip solution. Wireless, there's plenty of people out there that'll do wireless. Cirrus Logic, actually, is another one who does it. Once again, you can also do DSL, Philips, AMD, National Semiconductors, everyone does DSL if you're interested in doing it. But in general, when we're going to be doing some sort of a little embedded systems box, we're probably going to do some social engineering and plug it directly into somebody's network. So you're most likely going to be interested in either Ethernet or T1, to be quite honest. Or something that's completely standalone, doesn't hook into any of that, in the case of like the keyboard monitor. It doesn't actually need to know anything about T1s. It doesn't need to know anything about Ethernet. It just needs to be able to hook into the keyboard. So that's awfully convenient. Depends on what you're looking to do with your embedded program. Now, when I'm talking about these things, especially if we're talking building some sort of a sniffer or a recording device, we've got a big memory problem because we're talking hundreds, thousands of packets going through that we're going to suddenly have to record. And this is one of the big problems we've got with embedded systems, is trying to get enough memory at a reasonable price that still makes your product small enough. You can go out and get a hard drive and wire it on in, but then you're talking, you've got extra size, you've got a larger power requirement. it's not really terribly convenient. So what you're looking to do is you want to save to memory, and what's the best, most practical way of doing it? You've got everything basically from a little flash chip where you can actually go write it onto a chip, and then they're fairly small. They're, I don't know, maybe about an inch long or so in average. So you can get some nice small chips to write it in. The only problem is when they're full up, the only thing you can do is either yank the chips or yank the board and put in a new board. You could stick a floppy in, but you've got the same problem as with a hard drive. Once again, you've got more power requirements, you've got size, and you've still got to be able to go move the floppies in and out. My personal preference is probably a flash card. They're a PCMCIA card. You can get anything from about a 2 meg to about a 32 meg flash card. You can hot swap them, and it's fairly small, so you're not talking about a lot of hardware to support it. And it gives you the ability to just yank it out, slap a new one in. It takes very little amount of time. Then you can go home, stick it in your laptop, and read what's actually been recorded on it. There's another way to avoid recording at all, and that is if you're hooked up to the network, you can just transmit to yourself. Have it hard-coded to send all the data, or record for an hour and then send all the data to a certain IP address. Do it over TFTP, perhaps. So this is always a way to avoid on the memory solutions, too. But remember, if you're going to be sending over the network, somebody may start wondering how come their mail server keeps sending 2 gigs of data every day to some strange IP address. So try and be a little sensible about this. In addition, if you're going to be building up a nice little embedded box, you're going to have to throw some RAM in it. Now, the good news is RAM is cheap. So what you want to do, it depends on how good of a coder you are when it comes down to it. How tight are you writing the code? How fast are you doing it? And how much memory do you actually need to process what you're doing? Depending on what you're doing, I'd say anywhere from about 128K for something small, which doesn't actually do an awful lot, up to several megs. The product I currently work on uses actually 64 megs of RAM. And that's just for the main controller. We're not talking the subcards. Okay, we're a little bit obscene, but I don't expect most of you to have to do that. You've got a question? For an OS, you've got a choice. If it's going to be something very simple that you're doing, you can probably write something from the ground up. There's several companies that provide OSs designed specifically for an embedded systems. Sourcecom does one. Nucleus actually makes a very good OS. If you take a look more on the free side, Linux even comes with an embedded version that you can use. And what's nice about Linux is it's cheap, and it's probably got drivers for just about any chip out there that you want to actually use. Depending on what you're doing, you may want to decide on scaling. We wrote our own. He wanted to know which operating system that I currently use. The company I work for, we wrote our own. The previous companies I've worked for, we tended to buy from Nucleus. Nucleus makes one of the best operating system kernels around that I've seen. It's fairly Unix similar, but it's designed specifically for an embedded environment, and it's clean, it's nice, it has great debugging features. And that's another thing you guys need to keep aware of. You're going to have to debug this thing. If you imagine you're going to slap it all together and have it work first time through, then you guys must be geniuses, and I want you to come on up here and give the speech, because obviously you're better than I am. I can't even write code that compiles cleanly the first time, usually. So imagining that I could slap together some sort of a box to do whatever I want and have all the code and all the hardware work immediately is fairly unlikely. In fact, if you even take a look at the first production boards of most companies, you'll find that someone's been slapping on little wires here and there to make up for the accidents that they discovered after they built the first batch. Yes? You're right. Buying the little PC boards is the most practical way because you don't have to worry about having hardware failures, and it gives you an easy development board. I suppose the reason I call it cheating is because, well, it seems a little easy, to be honest. I'm used to having to work with built-in microprocessors and having to do really engineer things from the ground up. The PC boards are great, actually, for the little home embedded systems programmer, because it's all there together. It's very easy to put software together on it, and it's really the simplest solution. So it's not really cheating. I find it a little too easy to really qualify as true embedded systems. Let's see, what have I got left? I've covered most of the basics I wanted to do, because I wanted to keep this kind of short so I could start answering questions. I don't know how many of you have actually built something or want to build something or are wondering why the heck they're actually sitting here still. Does anybody really have any questions? Okay, you, black shirt. You can do that, and there are actually some people that have built such Ethernet and phone lines in particular, both of which provide more power than you actually need for the protocol. You can you're going to have to be careful, though. Most of them, you build it to power off of them, but there's enough of a variance in the actual real-life use that sometimes it won't work. One company I worked for built a little modem that was powered off of the phone line, and it worked on about 70% of the phone lines. The rest of them were bouncing around enough on the power selection, so you actually had to plug in a 9-volt battery. So just remember, you're working in the real world, and not everyone's going to actually follow the spec. How long have I been doing embedded systems? I've been doing it for about 6.5 years. I started off in the modem industry. I'm now in the telecommunications industry. I specialize mostly in protocols, currently frame relay variations. Oh boy, everyone over here seems to like me. We'll just start you in the back with a big beard. One chip solutions. There are some of them out there. The ones that I have played with, I have hated. I find them generally pretty flaky. They always decide to do strange things and give out at you, give out on you at the last moment, usually the most critical moment. They've gotten better, and I haven't played with them in a couple of years now, and I've been told they've gotten better, but I've been really pretty unimpressed. Everyone who tries to slam everything onto one chip tends to leave things out. Next. This side's obviously pretty quiet. Do we? Oh, I missed you. Okay, we'll give you. Doing some sort of a solution where everything's added on via serial ports. This is actually pretty good. You can do an awful lot of things with serials. Everything from HDLC on to just slapping on another chip. It's very convenient. It's very quick. If you're going to do that, you want to make sure that whatever your microprocessor is, it has a lot of SCCs to handle it. Motorola tends to slap about 4 of them on a chip. MIPS tends to put about 2 on. You don't want to use an Intel i960. They don't put SCC ports on their chips. Each SCC port is going to do some sort of a serial interface for you. If you need a lot of serial interfaces, what I've actually seen people do is they actually will slave a second Motorola PowerPC chip to the original one just so that they can use the SCC ports. Next. Depends on what you're doing. When I was doing modems, I was the sole programmer for the entire modem code base. I then branched out I have worked on teams from anywhere from about two people to the current team I'm on would be a little hard to describe. My current chunk of it, I'm the only one working on it, but we've got hundreds of programmers working in the code base constantly. For simple little things that you're doing, especially if you're going to use something along the lines of a PC on a chip or some sort of a demo board where you've already got some software built in, you can probably do it on your own in a couple months if you know, if you're a decent programmer and you know what you're doing and you can read a spec. Right. Ideally, if you're not that very good at hardware, and God knows the hardware guys don't like me in their lab, your best bet is to buy some sort of pre-made solution, which means either the PC on a chip or a demo board. There's hundreds of demo boards out there using various different chipsets with various interfaces. You can very commonly find for somewhere between $20 and $70 a board with a microprocessor, an Ethernet chip, and a T1 chip on it. So you've already got just about everything you could need to hook into a network right there. They'll give you the power supply information. Usually it's something that it's like a 9-volt transformer you can just plug into a wall. You can gen up something independent if you actually want, but you can actually get a nice little box that has everything in it, and all you've got to do is slap on some code and put something around it so it doesn't look like this piece of circuit board flying around, which may actually make somebody suspicious. Okay, we'll go with you. Most of them don't actually deal with the protocols at all. It's going to be able to read the line, but if you want to be able to read the TCP/IP headers or determine what's actually within the data packet, you're going to have to write that all into your own software. Right, that's where you really want to be able to do the controlling of it anyway. Most Ethernet chips are only going to do the basics. It's going to read in the data and give it to you in a format that you can actually then read and process. You can actually buy Ethernet chips that'll do switching, but I don't see any of you really wanting to build a box that's just going to switch the Ethernet out. But I suppose there's possibilities. You can get switched Ethernet chips. You can get ones that are just going to be able to input and output. Single-chip Ethernets that do line driving, you can find some, yeah. In fact, Ethernet, you're far more likely to find a single-chip solution than in T1 specifically. So if you're going to be doing some sort of an Ethernet solution, if it's not being offered in a single-chip solution, don't go with the company. Okay, we'll go all the way over there. Black shirt. Yes, you. Okay, preferences for compilers and where to get ARM chip samples. For compilers, the past couple companies I've worked at, we've actually used one flavor or another of GNU-C. It works well. You can customize it out. It's pretty nice, to be quite honest, and you can get them to run with just about any microprocessor that you want to use. If you're going to go away from GNU-C, you're probably going to have to pay some money for the compiler. So I recommend, unless you really can't stand it, stick with the GNU. As for ARM chip samples, I don't know off the top of my head where you can get them, but I would recommend if you've got a specific vendor that you want to go through, you find out who one of their distributors are, and you start calling distributors. One of them, at least one of them, will give you samples, maybe only a single one. But most people are so desperate to get your business that they will send you samples. Oh my, there's another person from this side. They're actually starting to get spunky over here. Why don't you go for it? Depends on the he wants to know about Ethernet chips, whether they'll give you access to the packet as it's arriving or whether they'll wait to receive the entire packet before they send it to you. Usually you can get access to it as it's arriving. So you can start tweaking it almost instantaneously. They're going to throw it in probably into some sort of a ring buffer or shared memory that you can just start reading as soon as it starts putting any information in there. Okay, he wants to know whether I have to reload code onto my products when I'm doing debugging or if I've got some sort of an emulation. And the answer is it really depends on the scope of what I'm doing. The larger the project, the more likely I'm going to be loading the code on it every single time because I'm probably going to have flash and it's probably easier to plug something in like a logic analyzer just to watch things. The smaller it is, the more likely I am to actually do some sort of offline emulation, to be quite honest. A lot of people like GDB. I can't stand it. If you're going to actually plug some sort of an emulator in, you're probably going to, it's going to cost money because to get an emulator, people don't give these things away as samples, unfortunately. You can do a software emulator, which is going to get you a certain amount of information, but eventually you're going to have to run it on your actual product, which means if you're trying to do it in one-time blown PROMs, you're probably going to have to burn, I don't know, half a dozen to a dozen of them minimum. If you're going to be doing on something that's erasable or flashable, it's not that inconvenient. You might be able to get your hands on something that'll actually plug in and pretend to be the PROM, in which case you're talking some sort of a hardware emulator. Applied Microsystems makes a couple really good ones, to be honest, but you're going to be paying money. These things don't come cheap. We're talking about $10,000. If you want to do this, make friends with some sort of a software or hardware engineer and get them to let you into their labs on the weekend. Okay, go for it. Okay, this is about debugging and how much effort's actually involved in debugging. Depending on what kind of a solution you're going with, depends on how much debugging you're going to be doing. If you're doing a very well-known microprocessor, your debugging time's probably going to go down a little bit because let me warn you, there are going to be bugs that you find that just aren't in the manufacturer's documents. And sometimes you'll never convince them that they've actually got a problem. So the more well-known the processor, the less likely you are to run into undocumented problems in their hardware. If you buy a pre-made solution, some sort of a demo board, there's less likely that you're going to actually have hardware problems. You can remove those as another time saver. This leaves you just trying to figure out what the heck your software is doing and whether the hardware actually when you actually tweak this pin, does the hardware actually do what it says it's supposed to do? And it doesn't always. Once again, the longer it's been out, the less likely you are to find out that even though they say this one pin can be floating, you always have to keep it grounded if you actually want to see over the first 32K of memory. So once assuming that you've got all the hardware problems worked out, on the software, you can do a good chunk of software-based emulation. GDB, once again, we're going to go with the free stuff, is not bad. I don't like it, mostly because I've used some of the really nifty hardware-based debugging and I'm spoiled. But if you want a real cheap, simple solution, that GDB in itself will probably take care of 80% of all your problems. Eventually, you're going to have to run this on the actual hardware real time. And the problem when you start doing this is you're limited in the amount of ways you're going to get information. If you've got access to it, you can throw on a logic analyzer and actually watch how various pins and data is being twiddled. But this is kind of difficult, and let's admit it, logic analyzers are not cheap. Your best way, unfortunately, once you're actually running it on your box, is like printfs. It's completely backwards, but the printf can be your best friend. I do a good chunk of debugging, actually, via the simple printf statements. Assume for every week of coding you do, it's going to take 2 weeks to debug it. Okay, way in the back. good point. He did mention that you can do some logic. If you're cheap and you're not too worried about speed, you can throw on some sort of a logic analyzer card into your PC or slow down the processor enough to be able to actually talk to it over your parallel port. This is true. Just remember, sometimes bugs will not happen at a slower speed, and they will when you speed up. I've seen things where just actually plugging on an emulator pod or even a logic analyzer pod slows things down just enough that we're on the border of some sort of a waveform that it'll work. And the minute you unplug it, everything goes flaky again. In fact, I've got a friend who spent 3 weeks trying to trace down what the heck the hardware problem was, because every time they stuck on any sort of debugging equipment, the problem went away. So just remember, timing can be a royal pain. Oh, also, on the logic analyzer front, you can probably find some old ones, old used ones, that you can probably buy pretty cheap. They're not going to do all the nice new fancy things as the HPs do currently, but if you just want some real simple, if you want to just be able to see what's going on, a good old-fashioned 12, 20-year-old bargain basement logic analyzer is probably going to work for you. Either I'm a complete genius or you're very bored, because I'm not getting... Oh, I got a question. Go for it. Embedded systems websites. I've got to admit that most of what I do, if I'm going to get information, I actually read journals on it rather than going on the web for information. Embedded Systems Journal is a very good magazine if you actually want to do any research into it. If you're actually looking for information just on specific chips, you can go to the manufacturer's site. They're going to be able to give you full data sheets. Quite often you can download samples of code to make this thing work. It's very nice. I logged on, for example, let's find one of these. Let's pick up one. Oh, we'll start here. National Semiconductor. I got just a basic little description here. In addition, I could have gotten the entire spec, which was a PDF file for 182 pages, which went into details about how to design up, how to connect this, what the waveforms look like, clocking cycles, power, everything like that. In addition, I could actually find some sample code. You usually can't find it as often for the T1 chips. Ethernet, you can usually find sample code that you can just download. For flash, guaranteed you can find code that you can actually download, and with very little changes will actually be able to get to work on your system. A lot of these people will actually have hardware diagrams of how you can wire in this chip into a standard setup. So you'll be able to download specs, schematics, code, everything. Your best friend is usually the manufacturer's website. If you can't find it there, you go back to that nice little vendor who gave you your sample chips and tell them you're having problems. Before you know it, they'll actually have some sort of a sales engineer out there trying to talk you through what's wrong. Circuit Seller actually isn't bad. They give you some good drawings. They tell you the details of the chips. They'll go in. I've still got a several-year-old issue which tells you how to build your own card reader for $25, which one of these days I'm actually going to do. Circuit Seller's really good for the home hobbyist. Again, I'm afraid sometimes being a professional, you tend to look a little higher than that stuff, which is why I mentioned things like Embedded Systems Journal. Circuit Seller is actually really good. Okay, portable prom burners. He was asking me if I know of anyone who manufactures some sort of a prom burner that is portable, so that doesn't require great gobs of power, and you can basically hook up to your laptop and be able to burn at will. I don't know anyone exactly. There are some companies that make prom burners that are fairly small and don't require too much power. I don't know any that work off of battery or off of the PC's power. You'd have to somehow or another plug in. Some of them will just require a little 9-volt transformer. Actually, in this case, Circuit Sellers, your best bet to take a look on. They'll probably list a good 20 or 30 different prom burners for you of various levels, and you may actually find one that's real simple. A lot of them you can actually plug into like a parallel port and burn your prom. Another solution is just become real friendly with someone who's got access to a prom burner at work and let them sneak you in on the weekends. This is real convenient because one of the benefits of a prom burner is if you've got code from another product, you can actually stick the prom in the prom burner and have it download to a binary file that you then can search through at will to find, oh, clear text if you want, or anything else. Twiddle a couple bits and all of a sudden it works a little bit differently than intended. So this can sometimes be really useful. Okay, the question is about the embedded systems in cars. Are there any websites to be able to go to find out information about the actual chips, the chips that are running inside your cars? The answer is I'm sure there are. I'm not aware of any off the top of my head. I know of a lot of companies that offer to sell you modified versions of various chips for your car. One of the most common is to get rid of the speed limiters. I don't know too much more about that. I had a friend who somehow had a connection back in GM, and he was actually able to get modified code for his card, and he just came into work and burned himself a new prom, swapped it out, and suddenly was able to get much better gas mileage out of his truck. But I don't know of any website specifically. I'm sorry. FPGAs, do I ever use them? Those are usually, I personally don't use them, a lot of people do. That is generally considered more along the lines of hardware engineering over software engineering, and the hardware engineers don't particularly like me in their domain. Something about me tending to destroy just about anything I put my hands on. They're nice, they're a little expensive, they tend to do very customized things, much like ASICs. They can do some stuff, but you're still going to have to throw a microprocessor in it, and for the general little home hobbyist, you're probably just going to want to do a microprocessor and give up the little extra speed that you get. Oh, okay. He wants to know about mailing lists or news groups to be able to find out about this. I haven't done a lot of research into it. I know there's a couple news groups in the alt comp area. I don't remember the exact addresses where they talk about some of that. I've popped in once or twice when I've had to ask a very specific question and generally gotten one or two good responses, followed with a lot of crap that I don't want to have to deal with, so I don't pay attention to them very much. He wants to know if there's any groups that are talking about what people are working on currently, talking about nice, new, cool stuff and things like that. The answer is I'm not sure. I've seen one or two that purport to be so on the internet, but I find most of them start off with someone presenting something and they devolve very quickly into flame wars. Oh, well, you must be a complete idiot because of blah, 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 blah. And so it's very hard to actually get very useful information out of them. If you actually find one that's worthwhile, I'd be very interested. He wants to know about the iBus by Dell, whether there's any back doors and how to hack that. I don't know too much about it, but the first way to go around finding out if there's any back doors is to get all the information on it. See about getting a spec, see if you can get some sort of a schematic or draw up on it. See, most of these companies are going to show you how the thing works in some degree or another. Once you have an idea how it's actually going to work, you can start finding holes and figuring out how to hack it. But first you need to find out how it works. So I'd recommend going out and getting every single piece of information you possibly can get on the iBus and spending the next couple weeks being totally immersed in it. You'll probably find bugs. I haven't found anything where there isn't a bug in it somewhere. Nothing else? Right, yeah, you're talking basically about the PC on a stick I was mentioning earlier. He said he was at Comdex and he saw a little PC just on a small board. There's a company that makes them, calls them PC on a stick. They do a little PC on a cube, which is like, so big or so, which has everything built in. This makes it really convenient, easy to develop, and let's admit it, there's 3 trillion pieces of software out there that'll actually run on the PC, which takes your development time and minimizes it extremely. These are probably good ideas for the home hobbyist. However, if you're going to get serious and you want something to that's going to work in a very narrow field, you're probably going to find that this is a little bit too broad for what you want. However, for a starter, it's probably ideal. We're all happy? Oops, I see another question. Hold on one sec. Oh boy, he's asking about testing cycles. There's these wonderful, great little design plans that come out that never actually work. Usually what's happening is you end up writing your code probably 2 months before there's actually any hardware for you to stick it on. You're hoping and praying that the hardware will actually get done before you get to the point where you cannot write any more code. When that happens, you slap your code on and you spend the next 3 months hand in hand with the hardware engineer at 1 a.m, tearing your hair out, trying to figure out whose problem is going on. It's really painful if you don't have already well-developed hardware because you're trying to figure out whose problem you're trying to debug, whether it's software, whether it's hardware, and whether it's easier to fix in software or hardware. Usually, if it can be fixed in software, that's where to go because, let's admit it, software's cheaper, it's easier to change, hardware's a royal pain to have to go wiring stuff up to. So there will quite often be knockdown, drag-out fights with people screaming at each other because the software guy doesn't want to have to fix it in his code and the hardware guy refuses to fix it in his code. And, yes, blood will sometimes occasionally flow. But in general, it's going to probably take 2 to 3 months. Well, for a large board. For a small board, it's probably only going to take a couple weeks to debug the hardware. The software usually is going to take longer. Unfortunately, sometimes there will be a hardware bug that will not show up until many months actually into the development and debugging cycles. Sometimes will not even show up until you actually change software enough. I've run into problems where it works perfectly fine on one version of software and the next version it breaks and everyone blames the software until you discover it's actually suddenly exploiting a hardware bug that no one knew existed. That's one of the benefits about buying demo boards or a little PC on a stick solution is you're avoiding a lot of the hardware pains. Tapping modem connections. First thing you're going to have to do is you're going to have some sort of access to the line that the modem's either coming in or out on. You're going to have to plug in some sort of a box that's going to take either a phone line or a T1 in and out. Secondly, you're going to have to know, the easiest way would be to know what speed, what type of modem the person's running so that you have an idea what protocols you're going to want to be running also. Basically, to be able to tap a modem connection, you're going to need a modem data pump to be able to translate this into something you can read. So you're almost going to have a modem to begin with and then just modify it somewhat. This is not terribly convenient. You can have something that's going to just collect the data and spit it out to you, but to translate that data into actual usable terms, you're going to need a modem data pump. And depending on what type of a modem you're talking to, you're going to need the appropriate data pump, because everyone knows that not every single data pump's quite as compatible as they claim it to be. Okay, now is everyone happy? Okay, thank you.